10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Welcome to the show. Whether you're listening in the morning, the afternoon, or the evening, I am Freya Odell, and in today's show, I will be talking to Dr. Arlene Holmes Henderson, if I can get my voice above the motorbike outside. She is a senior research fellow and policy leader, and we'll be discussing the importance of a classical education alongside oracy within the classroom. Let's go.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Hello, hello, hello. Live from Rome, or not so live, because I am now doing the pre-recorded shows. Welcome to today's show. I'm going to be talking to Dr. Arlene Holmes Henderson, and I'm really super excited about this, having followed Arlene for a while. She is an absolute expert when it comes to the classics in terms of classical literature, and I'm very excited to also talk to her about her current research on the importance of oracy in the classroom. I think I can see that she's just joined, which is fantastic. We've had a few technical issues this afternoon. There's always technical issues. Arlene, are you there?
I am here, Freya. Hello.
Yes, we got there, which is fantastic. I was just saying how I'm so excited to talk to you, and I just feel there's so much for us to talk about.
Yeah, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me on.
Oh, you are more than welcome. So how are you doing? How's summer for you at the moment?
Summer is great. Yeah, we've had some lovely weather in the UK, so that has been nice for a change. And yeah, busy, busy. I'm doing a lot of writing at the moment, so I'm staying out of mischief for the best part.
I love that. Summer sun and writing. What could be better, right?
Yeah, it's a good combo.
Okay, now I've been following you for a while, and I've been doing some further research ahead of today's show, but I always like to start the show with my guests introducing themselves. So perhaps for the people listening, could you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your career to date?
Sure, yes. So people can probably hear from my accent that I am Scottish. I am from Glasgow in the west of Scotland. I studied classics at university. I did my undergraduate degree at Oxford. I was then a postgraduate student at Harvard and then at Cambridge. And I then went into teaching, and I was super happy as a secondary school teacher of Latin, classical Greek, ancient history, and classical civilization for more than a decade. I taught in both the state sector and the independent sector in schools in Scotland and in England. But whilst I was teaching full-time, I was doing my doctorate in classics education part-time. And I left high school teaching in 2014. And since then, I've been running a number of classics education research projects. And I would be happy to talk a little bit more about them with you today.
I mean, the list of what you are actually involved with is quite extensive when I was looking around at everything. I mean, you are very, very busy. Where does that passion for the classics come from?
So I was really lucky. I went to a school in just outside Glasgow where Latin was taught from first year. So I, at primary school, had absolutely no access to the study of classics whatsoever. So I wasn't one of those kids that was like super interested in Greek mythology or the gods and goddesses from, you know, age six. That wasn't me at all. But in my very first day of high school, I had a Latin lesson because everybody learned Latin age 11 and 12. And I just loved it. I just had this immediate affinity with Latin, and I could see English words popping out of the page through the Latin words, and that kind of love for word nerdery, the etymology factor, is something which, you know, has never left me. And so I guess the Latin is what got me hooked, but Latin is a kind of two for one subject. So you get the language element, obviously, but you also get the Roman history and the culture and all of the civilization elements too. And as I continued my study of Latin through high school to standard grades and then higher, and then in Scotland advanced higher, I loved the fact that I also got to learn a lot about the way that the Romans lived.
Do you know, and I'm going to make a confession right now, because obviously I live in Rome and I'm just going to be mortified at my lack of knowledge as I'm speaking to you today. So I'm going to front that up and apologize straight away. But I am going to say how wonderful it is to live in Rome and have a little sort of keyhole into some of the things that perhaps you're going to talk about a little bit later on.
Yeah, and maybe you'll leave with some top tips of places to go and visit after today's show. Maybe you'll leave with a list of places to go and tick off this summer.
That would be amazing. That would be amazing, definitely. So one group that you're involved with is the Classical Association, right?
Yes. Yeah, I'm the outreach officer of the Classical Association and a council member and a trustee.
Okay, so I was looking at the information there, and it says that the Classical Association is dedicated to promoting the study of the language, literature, and civilizations of ancient Greece and Rome. So I think my first question is, why do you think, or why do you believe that the study of this is so important in our classrooms?
Well, I first and foremost think that it is enjoyable and interesting. Mm-hmm. So from a really personal perspective, it's something which I got a lot from when I was at school. And I see through my research now that we have a percentage of the population, particularly in England, who have that opportunity to learn about the Greeks and the Romans and other ancient civilizations, because currently at GCSE, it's not just about the Greeks and the Romans, it's also about the Persians. And, you know, that's largely the preserve of those who attend fee-paying schools in the independent sector. And I don't think that that is fair. It is not fair that those people who attend independent schools have the opportunity to study the ancient world. And it is a lottery as to whether those people in state schools have the chance to study it or not. My research shows that you've got a much better chance if you attend a state school in London and the southeast of studying classical subjects than you do elsewhere in England. So I think it's really important that young people have the opportunity to study these subjects. Will they get something from it? I think they will, but they should be given the chance to, because those people in the independent sector almost certainly will get the chance to. And I think that it needs to be more equal than that.
I love that. And I would totally agree with you. I mean, I obviously work in the international private sector, but I absolutely agree with you that everybody should have the opportunity to study. Now, you've said that you want the pupils to take from it. What do you think pupils take from accessing classical lit? I suppose for me, I'm approaching it from an English practitioner point of view, from approaching classical literature. What do you want pupils to take? What do you think they would take from it? I think, but I'm interested to hear you.
Yeah, so from the literature perspective, I guess the text that you might be teaching in your English literature classes, there will be a lot of classical allusions. So when you study the original texts, you have the opportunity to see where later writers have taken their inspiration from. And that clearly enriches your reading of later texts. You can see where people like Shakespeare have taken their ideas and their inspiration when they have, for example, been reading Ovid Roman poet, or Homer, a Greek epic poet. So yeah, definitely the ability to understand the allusions and the references, but even things like, you know, Achilles' heel or a Herculean task. These are phrases which are fairly common parlance in English, but understanding who Hercules was and what his 12 labours were and why he had to do those labours, that suddenly increases what Ofsted might call cultural capital. And that phrase is really contested by educators nowadays. And so I use it, you know, with quite a lot of trepidation. But Ofsted, you know, and particularly Amanda Spielman, has, you know, certain investments in that type of cultural capital.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I love what you're saying there. I think there's a number of different things from a English teacher's perspective, in terms of, one, you're really looking at the growth of literature over time, aren't you, and how certain classical texts have influenced future writing, which is a really, really important thing. And I know David Dadao talks often about the conversations in literature. And I think that's really, really important. But then you're also talking about the language and the origins of language and, you know, keywords and idioms and all of that kind of stuff. And then I suppose also, because I am actually currently writing a unit on classical literature, you're also looking at the form and the structures of stories at that time, especially because they were, you know, predominantly spoken. They were articulated rather than written.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Freya. And I have recently collaborated with the English and Media Centre, Barbara Blayman, on resource all about the Odyssey and storytelling, which is part of their Cultural Conversations series. And I think that resource will be really helpful for English teachers who want to see the Odyssey as part of this evolving cultural conversation over time, using storytelling as a lens. And I have been particularly impressed by Barbara's creativity in interweaving a number of different cultural stories taken from all across the world over different time periods. So I learned a lot from that resource. Obviously, I was coming from the classics perspective.
Yeah.
But I really do think for a key stage three audience, that is going to be a very rich resource. And I also think that from an English perspective, the Greek theatre texts are something which both teachers and students enjoy reading very much. So when I go into schools and I talk to audiences, often they want to hear about Antigone or Medea or Lysistrata, because the origins of theatre and the performance of theatre and drama in the ancient world is something which can provide a really good foundational base on which then to think about for future performances and the type of drama text that you might then read on current specification documents from exam boards.
I love that. Obviously, I have quite a narrow perspective in terms of being an English practitioner, but what would you say is the relevance beyond the sort of English teacher curriculum for classical sort of civilizations and studying that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So one of the projects that I am involved with is called Advocating Classics Education. And that project is based at King's College London. I work with Professor Edith Hall on it. And we've been going since 2017 with funding from the Arts and Humanities Research Council. And there, we're really looking to widen access to the study of classical civilization and ancient history in non-fee-paying schools around the UK, working in partnership with 16 universities. And we have been working with English teachers, but also teachers of other subjects. So the idea is that we find teachers in schools like you who are interested in classics, And we upskill them to be able to introduce classical civilization or ancient history at Key Stage 3 with a view to introducing GCSE and in time AS or A-level. We certainly have worked with a number of English teachers because, as you can see, there is a lot of parallel and overlap between English and classical civilization. But I would say we've had a number of other kind of key subject areas. One is history. So history teachers often express an interest in finding out more about ancient history. So we have two qualifications available which study the ancient world in translation, classical civilization and ancient history. And so listeners might think, why are there two? Why does OCR offer these two qualifications? That's a bit odd. And it's because their focus is really very different. Classical civilization is looking at themes in social and domestic history, things like women in the ancient world, myth and religion in the ancient world, and ancient history looks a lot at people like Cleopatra and Alexander the Great, and does look a lot at politics and war. So history teachers often are very attracted to the source analysis elements of ancient history, and they say, well, I can see that ancient history mirrors the assessment objectives for the history course really very closely. We would be interested in introducing ancient history to our school to provide an alternative to history. We also work very closely with citizenship teachers because from their perspective, the rights and responsibilities, the origins of democracy, some of the more philosophical elements of classical civilization appeal very much to them. They want to think about the politics. We also work quite closely with religious studies teachers because everyone loves the Greek and Roman gods and goddesses. they think, well, polytheism, you know, that's something we teach. We are very interested in myth and religion elements of classical civilization. The role of religion, both state religion and domestic religion, was huge for ancient Greeks and Romans and Persians. That forms a really large part of the classical civilization course. That is something which religious studies teachers feel that they already are subject specialists in. It wouldn't take very much upskilling for them to be able to teach the other parts of the course. So it's not just English teachers who are thinking about introducing classical civilization or ancient history. We work with subject specialists in a range of subjects.
So I've been furiously sort of making notes there, and I guess there's two things that I want to ask you about. So if I go with access first, you are very much coming from the perspective of using it as a leveler between those in private, because private students are getting the access to the classics that state students aren't. So my first question would be, why do you think that is? Why do you think that pupils in the state sector have shied away from the classics potentially? And then what was really interesting for me was that your research has shown that perhaps students in London and the Southeast are getting access to the classics, but less so elsewhere in the country. Is there any reason for that?
So these are brilliant questions, Freya. So to answer the first question, I think some of this is to do with expectations.
Yeah.
So I think there are some expectations around the availability of classical subjects on the curriculum in independent schools. And some of it is around teacher supply. So the reality is that currently we have more demand for teachers of classical subjects than we have supply of teachers of classical subjects.
Yeah.
So there are only three, soon to be four, providers of PGCEs in classics: King's College London, University of Cambridge and Sussex. And so it's actually quite difficult to train to be a classics teacher. The places are highly competitive. There are some skits, and obviously you can go into certain types of schools without a PGCE, but most of the PGCE trained teachers could be absorbed into the independent sector each year, leaving not many teachers available for the vacancies which come up in the state sector. So that is why the Advocating Classics Education Project is trying to solve this demand problem by working with people who already have qualified teacher status, who are already working in schools as teachers of other subjects. And we work with them and with a charity called Classics for All, who fund training to provide bespoke training for those teachers in order to help them feel confident in the subject matter so that they can then teach classics in state schools. So I think it's not that there's any sort of reluctance from state schools to teach classics. It's just that we currently have a supply problem in getting classics teachers to state schools. And I have to say that Classics for All is doing an absolutely brilliant job. So this is a national charity that raises money in order to then fund training for schools and professional mentoring and support for state schools who want to introduce classics, and they're inundated with requests. So we know that primary schools and secondary schools want to introduce classics to their school curriculum at Key Stage 3, Key Stage 4 and Key Stage 5. This is absolutely a priority for many schools across the country. The answer to your second question is that historically, it has been more of a priority for schools in London. So the London Schools Excellence Fund, which was something which Boris Johnson was involved in a while ago, provided some initial funding for state schools in London to introduce classics. So historically, I'm talking about over the last kind of 10 years or so, there was some stimulus funding to get classics into London state schools. And Classics for All initially had a lot of support available for a London hub to spread classics across London called Capital Classics. So that is why I think there's such a concentration of classics available in schools in London and the Southeast, and not so much elsewhere in the country. But I would say that this is a work in progress. And Classics for All, I think, now has 17 hubs across the country. So they have coordinators of each of these regional hubs who are really happy to speak to any school leaders or heads of curriculum in schools, state schools. They work exclusively with, they fund exclusively state schools who are interested in introducing any classical subject. They are there to help.
I love that. And I guess that kind of brings me on to my second point with regard to embedding classical literature, and again, I guess I'm approaching it from an English perspective first, in the classroom. I think for me, we've seen a surge of classical literature appear with the introduction of what we would call the knowledge-rich curriculum and Ofsted's kind of new framework. And we've seen a surge of people adding things like the Odyssey onto their curriculum areas. And I wonder, and I've wondered, because sometimes I resist that kind of immediate response to things, whether people are introducing classical literature in a tokenistic or slightly superficial way. And so I guess my question to you is, how can we ensure that it isn't presented in a tokenistic or superficial way, and that we are making classical literature available to all young people and engaging them with it and its importance and its value? Quite a big question there.
Yeah, that's a big question. I wish I could just wave my magic wand at the moment and solve that problem for you. I guess my first reaction is something is better than nothing.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you know, I feel like for decades
it's been ignored.
my sense is that, young people have gone through school and had absolutely no access to any classical literature. So I feel like if teachers are now introducing the Odyssey in any form, I'm like, woo, well done. Yeah. Great, you guys.
Yeah.
Thank you. I guess my second reaction is, I really hope that this English and Media Centre resource on the Odyssey as part of their cultural conversation series could be a possible solution to this problem, because I think it has been very well thought through and solves that potential tokenistic element of sprinkling a little bit of classics in the curriculum, and actually does produce something which is fairly meaty and rich. But what I would also say is that the Classical Association, the National Subject Association for Classics, of which I'm the outreach officer, we offer a lot of free continuing professional development. So we would be absolutely delighted to welcome teachers of English to any of our virtual or face-to-face training. And we want to support the implementation and delivery of classics in the curriculum. So we don't want English teachers or teachers of any other subject to feel like they're in this alone. There are lots of classicists in schools and universities across the country who are cheering you on and want to help and support you. So please just reach out and we will do everything we can to help.
I absolutely love that, because I mean, we've just introduced a classical kind of literature unit, and I was so nervous starting to, you know, in terms of the starting point and where to start and how to begin and my expertise. And I think expertise is something that's become really, really important recently in education, again, with lots of movements, the framework from Ofsted, blah, 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 blah. And I was really, really nervous because I don't feel like I have the expertise. And I absolutely love that you're talking about all these different opportunities. So could you quickly do a run through for us in terms of where people can find out more or learn more? So you've got the Classical Association.
Yes, so the Classical Association is the National Subject Association for Classics. We offer continuing professional development, both online and face-to-face. We also offer grants to schools and to organisations who want to do classical things. You will find all about that on our website.
And what is the website? Do you know what the website is?
I can send a link to it. I think it's probably classicalassociation.org.
Amazing.
And Classics for All is a national charity which supports the introduction and extension of the teaching of classical subjects in schools. They provide funding for teacher training. They will also provide cover costs if required in order to release staff for training. They will also provide ongoing professional mentoring and support. And they, as I mentioned, have these local hub coordinators. They also have developed a number of resources. So they have like a word roots course. They have mythology courses for Key Stage 3. They have a bank of resources for teaching ancient history at Key Stage 4. They are really great, very supportive, and they only give money to state schools. And I highly recommend that anybody who's interested in introducing classics speaks to their local hub coordinator. You can find everything about that on their website. What I would also say is that there are two further organisations who provide funding. And at a time when school budgets are being forever cut, I think that these organisations are in a really good position to be able to help teachers who just want to widen access to the study of the ancient world for their students. So, would you like £500 to buy some books about ancient Rome or buy other types of resources about ancient Rome? Yes.
Who's going to say no?
If you do, buy £500 for your classroom, £500 for your school library. Wow. That is amazing. Well, you only have to fill out a very short one or possibly two page form. The Society for the Promotion of Roman Studies, they meet 3 or 4 times a year. The deadlines are on their website. They give money to state schools, primary and secondary, And I would encourage people to apply for that £500 because you can get a lot of books about ancient Rome and Roman things, Roman life, even about Latin if you're interested. And that might just be the hook that a young person needs to get them really interested in classics. The other society is for Greek things. So the Society for the Promotion of Hellenic Studies also makes available between £400 and £600 for the purchase of materials, resources, and books about the study of Hellenic culture broadly defined. And again, on their website, you can find their 1 or 2 page form, and they will give that money to state schools. So you could potentially get £1,000 to buy resources about classic stuff for your school. And that might be a really great way to both upskill your own knowledge about classical stuff, but also get a sense from your students about whether this is something which they are sufficiently interested in to think about introducing classics to your curriculum and potentially at exam level.
That's amazing.
Everyone wants free money.
Well, don't we just? Especially when we're sort of uprooting, upskilling, educating ourselves, and obviously improving what we do in the classroom. We love it. But most importantly, I think you've left one thing out. What is your Twitter handle for people to get in touch with you as well and follow you and the amazing work that you're doing?
I am at Dr. Arlene HH.
Amazing. So we've got that Twitter handle as well. Right. We're going to go to the adverts. And then when we come back, I would love to talk to you about oracy.
Sure. Yeah, let's talk about talk.
Amazing. Right. The adverts will last for about 3 minutes and then we'll come back and talk about oracy.
Perfect.
Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. At Creative Resources, we've been rethinking what a classroom can be. We've created a huge range of more than 2,500 original and exciting resources that span across more than 15 different subject areas. Whether you're looking for primary or secondary level resources, careers options, PSHE, arts or humanities, Creative Resources have the resources for you. We offer full curriculum packages and unique challenging escape rooms themed on topics such as Shakespeare, Tudors and fractions. We have quizzes, task cards, Tarsia puzzles and lots more. Better still, more than 100 resources can be accessed for free. Just visit our website www.cre8tiveresources.com. You can get 10% off any order you make on our website by using the discount code TT Radio. Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club. Introducing the Leadership Masterclass Series by Diana Osagie. Learn how to ditch your fears and develop your leadership confidence. How to deal with difficult colleagues. How to thrive when you lead in a challenging environment. And how to get colleagues to buy into your vision. Join Diana for her online leadership masterclasses starting on the 10th of July and running all the way through the summer. These sessions are the perfect way to prepare and refresh for the next academic year and beyond. Book your place at courageousleadership.co.uk/events now.
The first 50 leaders to sign up get an additional free mini coaching session with Diana herself. Don't miss this. Courageous Leadership Masterclasses at courageousleadership.co.uk/events.
Okay, so I'm here with Dr. Arlene, and we have been talking about classics, classic literature, because I'm very narrow-mindedly thinking about English, but also civilizations with regards to embedding into our curriculum. And now let's turn our attention to oracy, because you've been doing a lot of work with regard to oracy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, my kind of segue from classics into oracy is classical rhetoric. So I wrote my doctoral thesis on the value of classical rhetoric for learners in 21st century classrooms. And for me, there is a lot of value in thinking about speaking and listening by using the tools and techniques which are taught to us by the Romans.
Okay, so for our listeners who might not be fully adept with rhetoric, what is rhetoric and why was it so prominent within Greek and Roman society?
Yeah, so different people in the ancient world had different ways of defining what rhetoric is. So Plato said that rhetoric is the art of enchanting the soul. Aristotle said that rhetoric is the means of persuasion in any given case. Cicero said that rhetoric is any speech that's designed to persuade. And Quintilian, who wrote the Handbook of Rhetoric, he said that rhetoric is the art of speaking well.
Wow. And so can you tell us a little bit about the origin of rhetoric within these civilizations? You know, how did it come to be? Yeah,
so we're not entirely sure how it came to be. In early civilizations, the way of getting what you wanted relied largely on military prowess. And then it evolved, and we're told that this man called Korax, and we don't know very much about Korax, but we were told that this man called Korax developed a rhetorical framework, and in order to secure property for himself, he used speech instead of military prowess in order to get what he wanted. And this framework is a kind of formula which it allows people to develop an argument. And it goes like this. There's an opening, there's a statement of facts, there's an explanation of what you hope to prove, there are the arguments themselves, the really key part is the refutation of your opponent's arguments, and then finally, the big conclusion. And this formula is what was used time and time and time again in the ancient world and has been used and adapted fairly successfully by orators, politicians, advertisers, broadcasters, people in marketing for the last 2,000 years.
And so I guess you've kind of answered the question in terms of, you know, why is teaching rhetoric really, really important for our students? Why is it beneficial?
So I think it's beneficial for a couple of reasons. One is, particularly when dealing with sensitive topics, so when thinking about citizenship, and sometimes in religious studies or PSHE, it can be quite tricky for young people to get their thoughts straight on a topic, and they might just want to, you know, say the first thing that comes into their head, not realizing that that can actually be quite upsetting for the people around them, because they've thought with, they've spoken without thinking. And so I think using the rhetorical framework is a very helpful way to work through in a step-by-step sort of way. It helps young people to structure their thinking on any given issue, particularly helpful nowadays on sensitive or controversial issues. And so that's where I think it can be really helpful in citizenship or PSHE. The other reason I think it's really important that we teach rhetoric is because one of the elements of rhetoric is the use of rhetorical techniques. And as an English teacher, Freya, you'll be really familiar with the learning and teaching of rhetorical techniques. And the fact of the matter is that people all around us are using rhetorical techniques. And they're using rhetorical techniques to persuade us, but also to manipulate us. They're using them to manipulate how we feel. And I think young people need to be able to read between the lines of communication. They need to be taught to be critically literate. And it's not until they understand how to deconstruct arguments that they really can construct their own arguments as eloquent and articulate members of society. And for me, as an ex-Latin teacher, rhetoric does this in a really effective and efficient way.
I love that. I love everything you've just said, and especially when I'm thinking about the classroom. I love this idea of actually using the framework to develop compassionate responses or arguments to something. I think that's really, really important, especially in today's society where we are frequently exposed to insensitive and this lack of compassion when talking about really sensitive issues. So I really love that. And then this idea about these techniques that we use, and you're so right, aren't we? We're manipulated every day by some person or organization or something we see or something we hear. And just being really, really aware of how we're being manipulated is quite a life skill that goes beyond English. And I love this idea about critically literate, which is an area that you're particularly interested in.
It is, yeah. So I was a Churchill Fellow in 2013, and I travelled to New Zealand and Australia and conducted some comparative international research on critical literacy education, because they have been teaching critical literacy and oracy in a very purposeful way in New Zealand and Australia for decades. And so I was very interested, as somebody who was researching this as part of my PhD, and somebody who was teaching this as a languages teacher, and I just wanted to know, like, what have they learned? What has New Zealand and what have educators in Australia learned from their decades of experience of teaching critical literacy and teaching oracy as named parts of their national curricula? And yeah, I learned a lot from that experience, and I published it when I came back. That research was then cited by a parliamentary commission in 2018 on critical literacy and fake news. And I was then asked to be an expert advisor to the all-party parliamentary group on oracy. And in April of this year, we published the final report of the National Inquiry into Oracy Education called Speak for Change. And that has been, for me, a really exciting professional process to watch that National Inquiry uncover. It was exciting to see submissions come in from primary school teachers talking about the learning and teaching of oracy in their classrooms, from secondary school teachers, from school leaders talk about how oracy has become a whole school priority, also from politicians talking about how important oracy is for them in their roles as a politician, and also from members of the public. So writing that report was quite a challenge because we had thousands of submitted pieces of evidence, but it was something that I really enjoyed doing, and I would say has definitely been a career highlight.
I love that, and I mean, I was reading again about the report, and you said in the report that comparably the UK really isn't offering a sufficient kind of education with regard to oracy, especially when you compare it to the work that's going on in Victoria, who you, I think you described as the gold standard in oracy in the classroom. What would you recommend that we be thinking about? I mean, it's really interesting because our school, actually, our focus next year is oracy in the classroom. So this is an area that I feel really, really invested in at the moment. What would you say is the gold standard in oracy in the classroom?
That's a really big question.
For I know.
And I think
I'm really putting you on the spot today. I'm really digging, digging deep here with you.
Yeah, you are. So the report includes a number of recommendations. So towards the back of the document, you'll see that we made a number of recommendations. And I have to say, they're not only my recommendations. So I co-authored the report with a number of others. So it's important to say that this was a collective effort, not only my effort. Some wonderful people worked with me on it. And I have to say that the classroom practice that I saw in Victoria was really inspiring. But in many ways, I think that that has been facilitated by the prioritization of oracy in educational policy.
Right.
And I do think, you know, people have views on whether, you know, whether this is the tail wagging the dog or not. But I do think that having strong policy support shows that there is interest at governmental level in making oracy happen. And Victoria, the state in Australia, has made it very clear for a long time now that they want their citizens, and it's very clear oracy is linked closely with citizenship in Victoria, they want their citizens to be articulate and eloquent members of society. They want them not only to be able to read and write, but also to be able to speak. And so the policy directive is very clear. And contrasting that with the situation in the UK,
yeah,
there's a marked lack of the inclusion of oracy or spoken communication in policy documents here. There's slightly more in Scotland's curriculum for excellence, but even there, it is definitely the poor relation of literacy and numeracy. So yeah, you'll see that the recommendations in the report, there's a section where we say that there could be more attention given to oracy in policy.
I think that's really, really interesting in terms of the lack of policy there. And I was just thinking about the UK and then obviously me working internationally, you know, even with regard to curriculum. So in the English curriculum, English teaching wise, again, sorry for my really narrow perspective, the oracy element became sort of mandatory, but not recognized in the same way as the sort of reading and the writing, and kind of diminished it in that respect. And then I think about the flip of that in the IB curriculum, for example, where there is a really strong oracy focus in terms of outcome. Now, I'm not saying outcome is the be all and the end all, but it does attach a level of importance to it, which perhaps is lacking at the moment. Although we have seen, again, in recent years, you know, School 21 and the work of Voice 21 trying to give greater prominence to oracy in the classroom as well.
Yeah, I think the work of Voice 21 has been groundbreaking. I mean, I really think that they have pushed forward the field, not only of oracy practice, but also oracy research. I think their model of working with oracy pioneers has been incredibly inspiring and is undoubtedly responsible for a lot of the evidence submissions, which we saw as part of the inquiry. So, I think that we owe a lot to the work of Voice 21 and the appetite from the profession, from what I see on social media, is that teachers in schools and school leaders in schools see that there is more to be done in this area. So I think this is something which we can work on together. It's maybe just a case of highlighting to the power brokers in government and those associated with government that there's more to be done on their side.
And if people wanted to read the report, where could they find that report?
So that report is super easy to find. All they need to do is put into a search engine APPG ORSA. So that's the All Party Parliamentary Group ORSA, and it will come up.
Amazing. And yes, the government and policy, really, really important. For teachers in the classroom, what would your immediate recommendations be to develop and enhance the use of ORSA in the classroom? What has your research kind of found?
So the research that I have been doing has been looking at where the strategic benefits can be leveraged most successfully. And the most interesting finding, I guess, I could share with you here is that...
Sorry. Is this like a news flash hot off the press?
Yeah, so part of the writing up of the report we did in April included a little bit of extra research that we did in collaboration with the Centre for Education and Youth. And what it showed was there seems to be a bit of a breakdown of communication between classroom teachers and school leaders in terms of perception of what is happening in terms of ORSA. So classroom teachers seem to be saying that in COVID times, ORSA was not a priority at all. They really weren't spending much time thinking about ORSA. They weren't spending much time planning activities which were prioritising ORSA or which were boosting ORSA because they were just surviving. When asked the same question, school leaders were of the impression that in the same classrooms, ORSA was a huge priority. And the activities that were happening in those classrooms were absolutely focused on ORSA and were improving the ORSA of those children every minute of every day.
Oh, no.
These were the results from the teacher chat polls which were done. So the research which I'm doing at the moment is trying to understand, right, so clearly there's a communication breakdown here between what's happening, what is actually happening in the classrooms with classroom teachers and the school leaders. So that is a local school problem. But from a research perspective, what can be done to improve the whole school rollout of ORSA education? And I think there are a number of organisations who are getting close to providing good models for this. But the pandemic has obviously provided additional complexities.
I always think it's really super interesting, you know, when you say ORSA, and I think, you know, when it was announced that ORSA was going to be our main school priority next year, you know, it's very easy, isn't it, to turn around as a teacher and go, well, I do ORSA in my classroom all the time. I ask questions, they answer, we do group work, we do, you know, talk partners and stuff like that. But with everything, it's about that strategic implementation and getting that really, really well and being more considered and careful in how and why you're using ORSA when you do.
Yeah, you've got it in one for you.
What I really liked when I was reading through the stuff this morning is, again, you know, we say ORSA, we say literacy, we say reading, we say writing, and they're really massive areas that ultimately take years to implement really, really well. I really like that it had been broken down into four key areas, I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong. So oracy for self-expression, oracy for knowledge, oracy for practical purposes, and oracy for exploring issues and problem solving. And I really, really liked that because it gives you something more concrete to work with in the first instance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as you say, it's helpful for providing a sort of framework in order to be a bit more focused.
Definitely, definitely. Would you say one of those is more important than any of the others?
No, I think what is important is when schools are thinking about the strategic prioritization of oracy, they are quite clear about what their goals are. And the goals within a primary setting might be different from the goals within a secondary setting. And that's why when you asked me the question, what does gold standard oracy look like?
Yeah.
It's very difficult to give a concise answer to that, because I do think that it depends on the setting.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. I think contextually that's quite an important factor, isn't it? I think for ours, it would be how they articulate themselves and make those convincing arguments. So going back to rhetoric or rhetoric, and then also how they problem solve and they discuss. I think that that's really, really core and very, very important and a life skill they'll need in future, you know, workplaces and environments.
Yeah, and I'm so pleased that you mentioned future workplaces, because you'll have seen from the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Oracy final report that some of the submissions we got were actually from employer groups. And they said that in research that they have conducted, time and time and time again, the key skill which thousands of employers say they want in employees entering a number of professions or graduate jobs or even apprentice jobs, more than any other, is communication skills.
Yeah.
So we know that in terms of preparing young people for life beyond education, what they really need is the ability to communicate well.
And I think that's fascinating, and it kind of brings us full circle in the sense of having worked in state secondary and having worked with private schools and having worked in the international sector, for me, actually, the biggest difference between those groups of pupils is not knowledge, actually, but it's how well they articulate themselves and the confidence they have in articulating themselves. And knowledge will be a part of that. But for me, if I was to look at what determines the difference in those two groups of students, it is absolutely their confidence in articulating their ideas, their opinions, having an opinion, articulating it well, backing it up, and extending conversational dialogue. That is a massive, massive area and potentially the greatest leveler.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I think that we should be aiming for the best for all students.
Definitely. I definitely agree with you. We are just about out of time. It has been amazing talking to you today. You are an absolutely incredible woman and so knowledgeable and so full of expertise. I could talk to you for hours. Thank you so much for joining me.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Freya. I hope we can do this again some other time.
I think we need to. I think we need to tease some of these things out more. And again, just for the listeners who are listening in, where can they follow you on Twitter?
At Dr. Arlene HH.
Thank you so much for joining me. It's been absolutely fascinating. And I hope you have a lovely rest of the day.
Thank you. That's great. You too, Freya.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.